coming to you across the ether at the speed of light. It's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells of Preferred Financial. My friends tell me I have a face for radio, and Carrie Deese, Ninja Processor, fending off those evil underwriters who want to turn your loan down. Join us for the next hour as we take a look at the ins and outs of mortgage financing. Well, Carrie, we survived our inaugural show last week.
Yeah, we barely did, but we made it through.
Yeah, we sounded a bit canned at times, but we're veterans now. We've done this before, so here we are this morning, more relaxed, ready to go at our show. We've got a big topic today. We're going to try to cover, over the next few weeks, some of the really important aspects of mortgage lending. And probably there is nothing bigger than credit scores. It's the starting point for qualifying for any mortgage. I guess I would say, wouldn't you, this is the most important aspect.
Absolutely, and the most difficult to understand at times.
It is. Very complicated, as are a lot of things in the mortgage world. So we're going to try to make them a little simpler for you. We have our word of the day to help us with that. And our word of the day is?
Today's word of the day is FICO.
FICO. Everybody has heard of FICO. FICO score. So what does FICO stand for? That's F-I-C-O. Does FICO stand for I-D-N-O?
I don't know.
I don't know. Does it stand for Fix-It Credit Operation? Does it stand for Fairly Invasive Corporation?
I think that's the one.
I think that's it. Or is it D, Fair Isaac Corporation, whoever that may be? Well, we'll give you the answer at the end of the program, so you have to stick around. Grab your cup of coffee, kick back and listen to us, and we can also take your questions by internet. You can reach us where, Carrie?
TheMortgageMoment@gmail.com.
And you can also call us on Monday morning at 864-235-9596. Get a real human being to answer your real questions. We're going to start by describing the credit system. The credit system is a lot better now as far as the available information. I know when we started the mortgage business in 1989, we used to use this teletype machine, and you'd type in somebody's name and their social security number, and about 3 hours later, this report would come out and be on that curly paper, you know, the heat paper that used to curl up, so you'd have to uncurl it to find out what was going on. There were no scores on it. We didn't even know that scores existed. We just got a list of people's credit accounts, their past history over the last 7 years, and that's really all we had to go on at the time. There were no automated underwriting systems, no scoring systems, and it was a long time before we learned much about what was going on. But we do know more today. We know that there are three credit bureaus. Those bureaus are Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. And we know that each of them, for mortgage purposes, uses a FICO model score. And we'll try to explain a little bit more about what the FICO modeling is. But I do want to say something here that crops up all the time. There are a lot of consumer credit monitoring systems out there. You can sign up for these on the internet. You've probably heard of some of them, but the problem that we find is that these systems never provide you with your true FICO score. Quite often they are using what's known as a plus or a vantage score. And these are just estimates of what the real FICO score might mean. So although it might be useful for tracking trends on your scores where they might be up or down a certain direction, we don't find them to be terribly accurate in regard to correlating with your FICO score.
And another reason for that, we do, for qualifying purposes, have to take the middle of your three scores. So if some of your accounts are only reporting to one bureau, your score might be higher or lower. And that's why it doesn't always correspond when it comes to what we have to look at for qualifying purposes.
That's right. Not all creditors report to all three bureaus. So you do generate some difference in your scores bureau to bureau because of that. There are other factors that affect your scores and can be different in different bureaus. But probably the biggest difference from Equifax to Experian to TransUnion is just the fact that not all creditors report to all three bureaus. So that's a good point. The scoring system, we know now, begins with a starting score. The FICO system does. of a starting score between 818 in Equifax up to 844 in Experian, and TransUnion is right in between those. And we finally found out after Congress passed a law in the mid-90s requiring the bureaus to disclose what factors most affected a consumer score, we began to see all of the factors, and we're quite surprised by a number of them once we saw them. And we now know that depending on the bureau, there are 38 to 41 factors that can affect a consumer score. Now, all of these factors, as it turns out, are negative. So, in other words, there's really no one who has a perfect score. I say that, and then, you know, we had that client a couple of years ago who turned in a perfect score in one bureau. It's literally the only one I've seen in 30 years of doing this. But technically, you're probably not going to ever have a perfect score, and there's no need to have a perfect score. The question really is how much have the factors that affected you impacted your individual score? Some factors interact with each other, and some factors are time-related. So sometimes we're asked to project or guess at where someone's scores might be if they do something, pay off a credit card, pay off a collection account, settle a judgment. And the truth is, I don't know if you remember your high school math, but there are things called permutations and combinations, and that is if you have like three or four things that can combine together, you've got like 40 possible combinations. Well, when you take the permutations of 41 factors and put them together, you can have millions of different scenarios and outcomes. So it's often difficult to just project where things are going. It's more, I think, an art than a science. And having reviewed thousands upon thousands of credit bureaus and tracked people that we've helped to reestablish their credit, we've begun to get a handle on how it all works. Now, when you pull a mortgage related credit report, the kinds that we pull, we do get scores, as Carrie mentioned, from all three bureaus, and we also get a list of the four factors that most affect your scores. And this is often a good indication of what you might be doing incorrectly or what you might be doing correctly. It gives us some guidance as to what might improve your scores, and we can help from there. There are different scenarios that we confront with all borrowers who come in across the spectrum of borrowers. Sometimes we're starting from absolutely no credit scores.
Mm-hmm.
We have a young borrower, or we have someone who for the last 6-7 years has just exited the credit system and hasn't borrowed any money. And they literally, when you pull up a credit bureau, there is no score. We also have people who are kind of restarting from a major credit disruption, maybe a bankruptcy, foreclosure, or maybe just a stretch in life where illness caught up or an accident or a job loss and someone's credit scores have been affected by some adverse credit. So in all the situations that we confront, the good thing to remember is you can always improve your scores. If you are unable to obtain a mortgage loan today, that does not mean you will not be able to get one tomorrow. And quite often, it's just a matter of knowing what to do. So we're going to talk about a little later this morning about the things that we do to both establish healthy scores, to maintain healthy scores, and to improve scores where they can be improved.
And we're always happy to help you with this at no cost to you. We just hope that once you get to the point where you're able to get a mortgage loan, you do consider going with us for financing.
That's exactly right. There was a time in my life I needed someone to help me start over, and there wasn't anyone there. I floundered around for years not owning a house because I didn't know you could recover. So we'll help you get there.
Welcome back to The Mortgage Moment. I'm Carrie Deese, trusty sidekick and ninja processor to Mark Wells of Preferred Financial. We are going to continue talking about credit this morning. And don't forget, you can always email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com or call us on Monday at 864-235-9596.
So we want to talk about the two different types of credit, both of which are really critical for establishing and maintaining a healthy credit score. One type of credit is an installment loan. Carrie, what's an installment loan by definition?
An installment loan is one that you just pay off the principal in a certain number of payments until you're done.
That's right. It's a fixed payment loan, so that each month's payment is the same. You may be able to pay more than the minimum payment, but that's all you're required to do. It's a has a fixed term, so it's going to be paid off when you make your last payment. Now, that's contrasted to revolving credit, which is what we typically think of as credit card credit, in which your balance can go up or down. Your payment can go up or down according to where the balance is going. You can pay it all off. You can pay it off with pay a minimum payment. You've got a lot of options with revolving credit, but in order to generate a healthy credit score, it actually is very necessary to have both types of credit in your credit report. Now, in terms of the factors, the items that most negatively affect your credit score, the obvious biggest hit to your credit is to miss a payment. Now, you might not know exactly what it is to miss a payment or to be late on a payment because your creditor, when they send you a bill, may tell you in that bill, payment is due on the first of the month, but late after the 10th of the month. Or with a mortgage loan, it would say payment is due on the first of the month, late after the 15th. But the credit scoring system does not consider you late until you're 30 days late. And at that point, you begin to incur damage to your credit scores. In fact, the highest hit to your credit score is to miss a payment. So that's an obvious one. But then there are a lot of credit score factors that are maybe not so obvious. For instance, the proportion of balance to credit limit on a credit card. Your credit card issuer gives you a certain credit limit. They won't let you charge more than that. But the more you approach that limit with your actual charges, the deeper your score will drop. And, Carrie, we've seen significant drops when people hit 80, 90 to 100% maxed on a credit card.
Sure. We see people all the time that have had perfect credit history forever that we can see on the report. And if their proportion of balance to credit limit is too high, it's a significant impact on the score.
We've seen 60, 80, 90 points. Mm-hmm. Again, this is for a borrower who makes all their payments on time, has never missed a payment, but simply is not managing revolving credit in a manner that results in good scores. So we found through a little bit of trial and error the point at which this factor begins to negatively affect your score. And we found that if your balance on your credit card exceeds 40% of your credit limit, then you're beginning to get some hits. Now, the hits don't become terribly significant until we reach 70 to 80%. When we get above 90%, it is a serious hit. So part of your proper credit management is to manage the balance on your credit card and not charge those up. The good news on this is if you do have a high balance on your credit card, the minute you pay it down, your score changes. There's some other score factors that take more time to sort your score out, but this is one of those instant changes. And indeed, sometimes people come in, they apply for a mortgage, their score's a little bit low. We'll actually say, hey, if you want a better rate, you can pay off this credit card or pay down this credit card, and you should gain 20 points, and that'll make your interest rate better.
And we say instantly, but we do mean when the creditor actually reports that you've paid it down.
Well, so that's true. That's
unfortunately, right. It's not
that
the next
can lag.
Day.
In fact, all the information in the credit system can lag the actual activity by sometimes 30 to 45 days.
Sure.
You have to wait on that. There were some new factors added in regard to revolving credit that came into existence about a year and a half ago, and they are what are known as look-back factors, and these also involve revolving accounts. Your look-back factors basically take a look at trends in your revolving credit history that have developed over the last 12 months, 24 months, and 36 months. And the trends that they track are, number one, has your balance over those times been generally the same? Has it been dropping or has it been rising? A rising balance over time can be an indication of credit distress, so you are actually penalized for that. And even a neutral line means that you're sustaining your debt, not paying it off, so that can be a negative factor. So what's the best practice with revolving debt as far as ongoing balance? That is to keep a trending balance that goes down and not stays the same or goes up. Another look-back factor actually says, did you just make your minimum payment on your credit card? Or were you making more than your minimum payment each month? You know, credit card issuers are more than happy for you to take all the time in the world to pay them back and make that minimum payment, because it'd probably take you 10 to 15 years to clear a credit card balance if you did. But the score system looks to see, are you making more than your minimum payment? If you're not, you actually get penalized for that. So trending balances on credit cards is a very important factor. I want to mention other factors that are what I call time-related factors. Now, in the credit system, time can be your ally or it can be your enemy, and it kind of depends on what it is and which factor we're looking at. For instance, if you had a late payment, time is your friend as you get further away from that bad incident. In other words, if you had a late payment a year ago, it's not affecting you as much as a late payment last month. And a late payment 5 years ago probably has very little, if any, impact on your credit score. It diminishes with time. Other time factors work against you. For instance, if you're establishing credit or reestablishing credit after a disruption, then you just simply will not build your scores until a certain length of time has passed in which you've shown that you can pay on time. And we find that there are thresholds that are important. At 12 months into a given credit cycle, you seem to get a good boost to your scores if that 12-month history is good. A 36-month cycle is even a bigger boost. So there are some time-related factors associated with your credit. There are several other things that can appear in a credit bureau other than installment loans and other than revolving credit. Carrie, what are those things that we see also in credit we have to watch out for?
Collections, while your utilities may not report when you're paying them well, if you stop paying them, they will most certainly report as a negative. Same thing with medical collections. You won't get credit for paying them well, but if you stop paying, they will certainly come back to haunt you.
That's right. In your credit report, there's a derogatory section. And in that section, any account that has gone into a collection status is listed. And these can quite often be from accounts, as Carrie mentioned, that were not necessarily credit accounts to begin with, utilities, medical bills, doctor bills, things like that. But they will show up if they're negative, and they impact your scores. There's always, we get the question from borrowers. In fact, sometimes they come in and say, well, I'm ready to buy a house, and I paid off all my collection accounts. And there are actually some times in which you do not want to settle collection accounts before trying to buy a house. And we're going to cover what those circumstances are, why you might not pay those off, because there are times where they can affect your scores negatively by paying them off. Now, I didn't invent the credit system, and I don't really agree with that. Seems like if you're willing to pay off a collection account, you ought to get some credit for that.
Absolutely.
But the opposite is quite often the case, depending on the age of the collection account. One thing I'll mention where time is your ally: if you have a collection account, that account cannot be reported for longer than 7 years on your credit report. At 7 years and one day, it drops off. It is legally uncollectible, and it no longer can affect your scores. So that's the reason we sometimes hold off paying off an old collection account, because it may be close to dropping off anyway. There's some other derogatories that can appear under public record. And Carrie, what do we find those are?
We definitely see judgments, tax liens, and bankruptcies.
Those three are considered public record filings. And they're a little bit different from a collection account. They are a demand for payment. A creditor who has taken out a collection account can take that demand for payment down to a magistrate or a small claims court or the proper court and obtain what is known as a judgment. The judgment is a demand to pay. Now, whether that judgment can be acted upon by the courts and force paid, that's a whole nother credit issue. But as far as your credit report itself, items of public record appear. They can be very critical in your obtaining a mortgage since they will attach themselves to any real property that you purchase. So if you own a house, a judgment will immediately attach itself, and if you sell the house, that must be paid off from the proceeds that are there. But also a judgment, even if all of your credit scores were good, everything else was fine, your debt-to-income ratios were within guidelines, the fact that you have a judgment would keep you from buying a house because that judgment is going to attach itself as a lien to the house, and the lenders will not allow that to be. There was some information floating around a little while ago that tax liens were going to be removed from the credit reporting system, but this would not remove them from public record. And again, they might interfere with your capacity to purchase a home. We're going to talk about how we might handle tax liens and judgments when we come back after the break. All of these are important as you are qualifying for a mortgage and moving towards a home purchase. We're also going to talk about, when we get back, what is a good score? What kind of scores are required to buy a house? This is one of the frequent questions we get, and the answer to that is it depends on the mortgage program that you're looking at. Real quick, Carrie, minimum score requirements for an FHA loan, are they?
Typically, you want to see about 580 to try to get an automated underwriting approval. Sometimes you can go a bit lower with extenuating circumstances, but we haven't seen that very often.
So 580 is a threshold for FHA. We'll talk about the thresholds for some of the other loans. VA, for instance, has a 620. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have no qualifying under a 620. We'll come back after the break and talk through all of these. We're back on the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells of Preferred Financial Services and Carrie Deese, providing mortgage broker assistance to all borrowers in the upstate for the last 29 years. We're talking this morning about credit scores, the importance of credit scores in your mortgage qualifying. And the credit score not only affects whether you will get a loan or not, but it also affects the interest rate you'll get, the amount you're going to pay over time. So of all the mortgage qualifying issues, credit score is probably the biggest and most important. That's why we're taking a lot of time on it. Before the break, we were talking about minimum credit score requirements. That's always a question that borrowers ask. What does my score have to be to get a house? And different programs require different score levels. Carrie, let's go back through that list again. For FHA?
FHA, you want to have about a 580. For conventional, you need to have at least a 620. For VA, you also need a 620. And for USDA, we usually see that we need to have about a 640.
And let me say this, that all of those scores are minimum threshold scores. You don't necessarily get a loan approval at those scores, but those are the points at which you have a chance of getting a loan. There are other factors that can be determined, down the amount of down payment, for instance, reserves, savings. We'll talk about some of those other things on other programs, but these are the minimum threshold requirements for scores. But as I mentioned, the scores also affect the interest rate you can get. So on an FHA loan, if your scores are over 680, you're going to get the best rate that is possible. However, on conventional loans, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that same score must be a 740 in order to get the best rate available. Again, each program has slightly different variations on these things. The goal is to get your scores as high as possible. We've mentioned the items that can affect your scores negatively. Carrie has mentioned that it is your middle score. So when you apply for a mortgage, technically the lender throws out the high score, throws out the low score, and goes with the middle score for your qualifying. They don't average the three scores, even though you'll see the average on your credit report. It's actually the middle score is your determining score. And Carrie, if you have two borrowers, let's say you have a husband and a wife buying a house together, and they have different scores, which is the determining score for the loan approval and for the rate?
Unfortunately, you have to go with the lower of the two middle scores.
That's right. So you may have one spouse who has a 760 and a spouse who has a 620. And unfortunately, it's going to be the 620 score that affects the rate. So from time to time, what we do to solve that issue is if one spouse can carry the loan within their income and debt guidelines, we simply let the other spouse remain on title. And we use the spouse with the better credit score to get the better rate so that they have a lower payment. Doesn't always work because sometimes we need both incomes. And if you bring a person's income into the transaction, you have to bring their credit in.
Yeah, we hear all the time, can we use my income and his debt? No.
That's right.
We'll cover that in more detail in another program.
But
unfortunately, it doesn't work that way.
So for all programs, better scores result in better rates. But also, in a new twist, relatively recently, PMI coverage, which is mortgage default insurance, has also taken on a score benefit basis. And that is, the higher your score is, the lower your PMI premium is. And even now we have programs that if your scores are high enough, you can avoid PMI altogether, even if you're not putting 20% down. So all the more reason to get your scores up. Now, in qualifying for a mortgage in the underwriting process, using your middle score may be sufficient to do the loan and to be qualified for the loan, but there could be some other things that stand in the way. We mentioned that judgments are one thing that can stand in the way of your loan approval, even if your scores are okay. And at this point, we really have to say that all judgments simply have to be settled in full in some manner. That doesn't always mean that they have to be paid in full, but they have to be settled in full before you can buy a house. We might have tax liens in place. In this case, the IRS, where it's normally very unfriendly to borrowers, actually can be friendly in this respect. And even though their tax lien would be recorded against your property and take precedence over the mortgage lien, the IRS is willing to have you enter into a repayment agreement and will allow you to record a mortgage over their tax lien if you have been into a repayment plan with them for at least 3 months before you apply for the mortgage. So a tax lien, although it is a lien on the property, that can be overcome by making payment arrangements with the IRS and making those payments. There's some other things that might interfere with your loan, with your mortgage approval. One of those, and we're seeing it more and more, are defaulted student loans.
Oh, yes.
Carrie, how do we, where do we find defaulted student loans? They're not always in the credit bureau. Sometimes they are.
Sometimes they will come up on a list called CAVERS, and I'd tell you what it stood for, but it wouldn't matter. But they come up for defaulted federal loans, and it will keep you from getting another government-type loan.
That's right. If you're using a government-insured loan, that would be VA, USDA, and FHA. If your name is on the CAVERS list and you owe the federal government money, they will not insure your loan, and you might have the best credit in the world, all the down payment you need, but you simply can't get one of those loans. There is, fortunately, for all defaulted student loans, a reinstatement program. The reinstatement program basically allows you to begin to make payments on a defaulted student loan. And if you make 6 months of payments on time, the student loan servicer will remove the student loan from a collection status, will put it back up in your active open account, and that will release you from the CAVERS list where you're eligible for a government-insured loan. All of these things can affect underwriting. We review all of these things for you when we do a checkup for you. We also help you where you need to do these reinstatement programs or enter into an IRS repayment schedule. Everyone's situation is slightly different, and we're happy to talk to you about your particular situation and find the solutions that are best for you.
And again, all of that is no charge. We are happy to just help you through that however we can.
So you can contact us by phone, 864-235-9596. You can also email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. Let's talk about a very common problem for our first-time home buyers. You're young. You're just out of school. Just looking at getting married, and you want to buy a house, and you come to our office and you say, hey, I'm ready to buy a house. Let's get going. We pull up your credit report and, gee, there's nothing there. Well, that's not too unusual with a young borrower. You haven't had time to have credit. You probably, when you were in high school or college, your parents made your car payment, if there was one. They may have put you on a credit card, but they may have just put you there as an authorized user, and it wasn't actually an account you were responsible for. So we pull up a credit report, and there's just no score there. Well, there's not just a quick solution for that, but neither is there some prolonged and protracted arrangement that has to be made to build your credit scores. So we start with this quite often, and I encourage young people to start this process long before they're out of school, and that is you need to establish your credit. So starting from scratch, starting from nothing, what is the fastest way to rebuild or to build credit scores? Well, we talked early in the show about how there are two types of credit, and you're going to need both. You're going to need an installment loan. That's a loan with a fixed monthly payment. But you're also going to need some revolving credit. And revolving credit, if you have no credit scores and you went down to the bank and you said, hey, I'd like a credit card, well, they're probably going to tell you the same thing as they would say if you said, I want to buy a house, and they're going to say, come back and see me when you've got credit scores. And this is kind of the chicken and egg thing. It's like when you try to get your first job and the person, you know, you're asking to employ you says, well, what's your experience? Well, you don't have any. Well, the same thing with credit. You're trying to get a house, but you haven't had any credit before. So how do you do it? Well, fortunately, there are some ways to do that. The first step we have a borrower take is to arrange to take out what is known as a secured credit card. Now, a secured credit card is not a debit card, although it's going to sound like one. A secured credit card is where you send to the credit card holder a deposit. We recommend a $300 deposit, and the creditor gives you a $300 credit limit on a credit card. You use it just like a credit card. You use it to charge things on. You get a bill at the end of the month, and you pay the bill off. But if you fail to make your payment, the reason you can get a secured credit card is because they're holding your $300 deposit, and if you don't make your payment, they shut your account down, they pay themselves off, and they send you any money that's left over. However, that defeats the whole purpose of trying to build credit scores. So anyone can get a secured credit card. We recommend at the starting out point that you get two of these. We have found that two revolving credit cards will build your scores faster. Although one is enough, two is better. But we've also found out that three is no better than two. So you don't need one, you don't need three, but two will do, two secured credit cards. And how we use those cards is going to be very critical in developing your scores. Once you've got the two credit cards, then you're going to need to also get an installment loan. We'll tell you how to go about getting that in the right way. And when we get back, we'll tell you how to use both of these without getting into debt. Our purpose is not to get you into debt, but our purpose is to show the score system that you can borrow and manage money.
Welcome back once again to The Mortgage Moment. I'm Carrie Deese here with Mark Wells, and we're going to continue talking about the best way to build your credit.
If you're starting from scratch, as we mentioned before the break, you'll need to establish two credit card accounts. And the best way to do that is by using secured credit cards. You can't be turned down for one of these because you put a deposit with the creditor They give you a credit limit equal to that deposit, and they're protected if for some reason you don't make your payments. They shut your account down, pay themselves off. So the starting point for establishing credit, if you have none, is to get two secured credit cards in place. Once you have those in place, then we need to get an installment loan history. Now, more and more we're seeing young borrowers come out of school with student loans, and those are installment loans. But quite often, they're deferred. So what we will normally do is take the smallest of those loans and just simply begin repayment of that loan. Even though it might have been deferred, we'll leave the others deferred, but we'll take one. And that's an easy way to get an installment loan history started. The other way is we do this in a manner that does not get you into debt. But you go down to the bank that you already have a checking account with, and you tell them, I'm down here and I need to establish my credit. And so I want to take out an installment loan. Now, one of the critical factors in an installment loan, it needs to be more than $1,600. And it needs to pay back in more than 1 year. So you absolutely do not want to go to a finance company to obtain an installment loan. It's easy to get one at a finance company, but there's actually a credit factor that will penalize you for using finance company financing. We'll talk about why that is at another time. But you want to go down to your bank, your credit union. You want to tell them that you're not taking out a loan because you need to buy something. You're not taking out a loan because you need to get into debt. You're taking out a loan because you need to establish your credit. You get and request a $1,600 to $1,800 loan that will pay back in 16 to 18 months, so about $100 a month. But you tell them, I'm not going to use this money. I want you to set up a separate account for me, a new account. I want you to deposit the loan into that account, and then I want you to direct draft my payment out of that account each month. Well, the advantage of that is you don't have to worry about missing a payment because they're going to draft it. You don't have to worry about where the money's coming from because the money's in the account. And all you really need to do is supplement the account, 10 or 15 bucks a month for the interest that's the part of that payment. And then the loan itself pays itself off. All we're trying to do here is develop a payment history, so we don't really want to get you into debt. The proper use of the credit cards is very much the same way. We don't really want you using a credit card to get into debt because that's what gets most Americans into trouble. And most Americans, when they come to apply for a mortgage loan, we have to tell them they've got work to do because they've mismanaged their revolving credit. So the proper use of a credit card is to charge a small amount on it each month. And by small, when you have a $300 credit limit, we're talking about no more than $30 to $40.
I usually just go and put my gas on it. I have
That's
the
right.
money for it. I'm going to pay for it anyway. So I just throw it on the card, and that way there's a consistent payoff of that card each month.
That's right. The key is a small charge so you don't run up your proportion of balance to credit limit and hurt your scores. But the key is also we're not trying to get you into debt. You take the money that you had cash for, and when you use the credit card, maybe even play a trick with yourself. Put it in an envelope, and at the end of the month, take it out. Because what we're going to do with that credit card at the end of the month is pay the balance off in full. This is going to save you all interest-carrying charges. You're simply going to use it for the convenience of using it. You're also going to trigger those factors, those look-back factors, in which you're going to show that your balance did not go up every month. You're going to show that you made more than your minimum payment each month, and your scores will build quickly. This is simple. We're talking about three accounts. Two secured credit cards and an installment loan, that is enough. We can promise you that if you do this, that when each of these accounts have a 12-month history, you will be able to qualify for any mortgage loan program there is. Your scores will be over 620 to 640 if you just simply do this. It's never failed to do that when properly used and properly done. Now, let's talk about not those who are starting from scratch, but another common situation, especially after the financial distress of the 2007-2008 and the intervening years after that. We have many people that are trying to start over from a major credit disruption. Carrie, what are some of the major credit disruptions that can hit people?
foreclosure, bankruptcy, maybe the death of a family member or someone in your immediate family, and you have a whole lot of medical bills and you're just unable to pay anything for a few months.
Right. And this happens. It happens to good people. It happens to people who are financially responsible. It can happen to anyone. What we don't want happening is for you to think that there is no hope, because the credit system, as we alluded to earlier, allows anyone to recover from any event, no matter how bad the event was. Now, there are two types of bankruptcies that you can file if you're in trouble. One is a Chapter 7, and in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, the court basically allows you to not pay off your debtors. You have to qualify for a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, and a bankruptcy attorney could tell you whether you could. That's probably the more common one, is a Chapter 7 where you walk away from your obligations. There's a second type of bankruptcy called a Chapter 13 in which the court restructures your payments and you make payments to the court, who then distributes those payments to your creditors. A Chapter 13 can take sometimes 4 to 5 years to pay out entirely. A Chapter 7 bankruptcy and a foreclosure are both probably the biggest hits that can occur to your credit, but they both can be recovered from. Let's talk about the waiting periods after this event has occurred. And for a bankruptcy, a Chapter 7, the point at which the clock starts ticking is at the discharge date, not the filing date, not when you went into bankruptcy court to ask for the bankruptcy, but actually when the judge signs off on it, says, yes, this is done and it's finished. That's your discharge date. And the waiting clock begins there. Carrie, for a VA loan, if you filed a Chapter 7 and you're a military veteran and you want to buy a house, what's the soonest date you can buy a home?
VA is actually the most lenient, and you can buy a home after 2 years from your discharge date.
That's right. You have your earliest eligibility, a recognition that veterans particularly may have some very extenuating circumstances that resulted in the bankruptcies, and they are allowed to purchase a home 2 years after the discharge date. For FHA and USDA, carry the other government-insured loans, what's our waiting period?
Those are both 3 years from the discharge date.
And for conventional, that would be Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Kind of some complicated rules, but basically 4 years after the discharge date of a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, if you have 20% down, you can get a purchase loan. If you're putting less than 20% down, it can be as long as a 7-year wait. However, Freddie Mac defaults to their automated underwriting program, and we have seen where people will put less than 20% down. We have seen in less than 7 years the capacity to buy a house, even after a Chapter 7 filing. Now, a Chapter 13, which is not quite as damaging as a Chapter 7 because you actually do pay your debts back. You just don't pay them back in full. That has a shorter waiting period. Carrie, again, for VA, what is that waiting period?
VA is only 1 year after the date of filing.
And the reason it's different, we noted with a Chapter 7, the clock ticks after the discharge date. But with a Chapter 13, you may be in it for 5 years. You can actually be in the process of paying out a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, and you are still eligible to buy a home using VA financing after you've made payments into the bankruptcy court for 1 year into a Chapter 13. Now, you have to have the court's permission to buy a house, but usually if your house is not going to cost you any more than your rent, the court is going to give assent and approval to that. How about for FHA and USDA?
Those are the same at both at 1 year.
And this is probably something most consumers don't realize, that you can actually be in a Chapter 13 and still buy a house. You just have to have made your first 12 payments to the court on time. Conventional, however, is a little bit different. Conventional will not allow for the purchase of a home until 2 years after the discharge date. And this happens sometimes, people will enter into a Chapter 13, cannot maintain their Chapter 13 payments and stop the Chapter 13. So conventional lenders will allow you to purchase a home 4 years after a dismissal. A dismissal is when you have not finished your bankruptcy. You just simply stop the payments. Now, there are foreclosures that are probably the next largest impact to the waiting period, and each lending class has its own waiting period. For Fannie Mae, it is 7 years after the deed transfer, unless you can prove extenuating circumstances. Carrie, what could some of those extenuating circumstances be?
We could have a job loss or a disruption in income due to a medical event or an accident.
And always when you apply for a mortgage loan, you have to provide supporting information to show that the extenuating circumstances indeed did happen. But with those, Fannie Mae will allow for you to acquire a new home within the 7-year period of having a foreclosure, never earlier than 4 years, but certainly between 4 and 7 years. Freddie Mac actually says that their automated underwriting system will determine it. However, in practice, we have not seen any approvals until after the 4-year mark there also, even with extenuating circumstances. FHA will allow a person who has had a foreclosure to purchase a home 3 years after the deed has been transferred. VA, again, has the shortest period of time. It's only 2 years from the deed transfer. And USDA is like FHA, 3 years from the deed transfer. Now, sometimes a person includes a mortgage in a bankruptcy filing. And if that mortgage was included in a Chapter 7 filing, then the waiting period begins at the discharge date of the bankruptcy rather than the deed transfer that occurred. Some of these things are complicated. Your situation is unique to you. We welcome your contact. Email at themortgagemoment@gmail.com or call us 864-235-9596. This has been The Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells and Carrie Deese, Preferred Financial. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next Saturday morning, bright and early at 7 o'clock on The Mortgage Moment here on WGTK, The Answer.